All right, this is Gary Parrott from CBS Sports, and this is the Ion College Basketball Podcast. I got Matt Doylander with me. I got Sam Messini with me. It's February 1st, early on a Monday morning, especially early for Sam, who lives in L.A. I'm in Miami, so it's 9 a.m. here. I'm basically cool. Norlander's on the East Coast. I'm assuming he's cool. Sam's dealing with a 6 o'clock hour right now, and he's a young man with no kids, so there's really never any reason for him to be up at this hour ever. So let's start with Sam. Are you awake? And if so, can I trust you'll stay awake until we're finished recording here?
I am awake.
You know what?
For
you
now.
Sound awake. You sound awake. You've sounded less awake than this at like 2 in the afternoon before.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. I still haven't had my coffee yet, and I am laying in bed with my dog. So I cannot promise you that this will sustain for the whole podcast, but I'm going to try my best and we'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, we'll see how it goes. Like you said, lots of stuff to get to, but let's start with Kansas's OT win over Kentucky inside Allen Fieldhouse. Norlander was there. It was his first trip to the place I believe is the best spot in college basketball. What do you think, Norlander? Did Allen Fieldhouse, before we talk about the game, Allen Fieldhouse live up to its reputation for you?
Pretty much did. Man, I could not have asked for a better game. I mean, for a first trip. I love the location within the campus. University of Kansas is a pretty good campus setup overall. And then the building itself isn't, from the outside, it's not like like Hinkle from the outside, like with the way that Hinkle's placed, like you kind of like turn, you can turn a few corners in a neighborhood, and then all of a sudden it's just like, it's there. It's like, you know, it's like one of the pyramids. It's got a very looming presence overall. Allen Fieldhouse is kind of just like, it's tucked behind a parking garage right there on campus. There's nothing that really stands out about it from the exterior really at all. But then once you get in, it's really cool. Because they've got, you know, the Kansas, you know, Hall of Fame, so to speak. And there's all sorts of really cool stuff. They've got the original. So anyone that's familiar with the building, and, you know, oftentimes the TV shot will cut away to the top of one end of the field house where they've got the sign, you know, pay heed all who enter, beware the fog. Well, that goes back to the 80s when a bunch of sorority girls, I guess, made an original version of that sign with a bunch of shower curtains, and they hung it, they like threw it over one of the rafters, and they hung it with like tied shoes and all this stuff. And apparently it was I learned that it was something of a like, it was a project, but it was like something of a drunkenly inspired one. And
love in there.
Anyway,
with sorority
the original
girls
one
either.
It's like really cool. The original one hangs right there in the lobby of when you enter from the Booth Family Hall of Athletics. And so all that stuff, you know, the Wilt Chamberlain and Kansas Athletics and all that is really cool. The setup, I can't like properly describe it in terms of like the building and the locker room and where it's located. It's like right there in the entrance. It's a really, really cool setup overall. The actual arena is super cool. It was definitely just an amazing thing. The student lottery they have set up. I mean, when I got there on Friday, I landed by like noon on Friday, and I pretty much wanted to get over there immediately to see the place. And I get there, and there are a bunch of students just, you know, sitting. It was almost like an airport where, you know, every flight is delayed. Everyone's just sitting on the ground on their computers, you know, just kind of hanging out. And I'm like, I guess this is them camping out, but I really don't understand what's going on here. And what they basically do is they have a lottery earlier in the week in the practice facility, and you can have as many as, I guess, 30 people in a group, and, you know, that you put all your names in whatever they do, and they draw it. And, you know, if you're picked first, then you have first dibs in terms of getting in line on actual game day to get to the student section. And then I took a photo. I can't really share it on Twitter because the names of some of these groups are hilarious and, I mean, vulgar as hell. Really, really funny, but yeah, so basically everyone sits in the lobby and you only need one group representative, and they take random roll call, And if someone from your group isn't there, then you lose your spot that you earn in the lottery overall. So you always got to have at least someone there. And which I thought was a really cool and interesting way of doing it. And that way you don't have basically 3,000 people camping out outside Allen Fieldhouse. What you have is inside of it, you've got, you know, 500 basically.
Well, they're trying to keep people from freezing to death, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't want, I mean, it sort of runs counter to the college mission to have a bunch of kids camping out. I know it's a great scene, like Krzyzewskiville and all that stuff, but and the Duke kids are smart kids by and large, so like whatever, I'm sure they're doing fine. But it has always like struck me as kind of strange that that we think it's a great thing that like kids who are supposed to be living in dorms and studying or camping out in tents. And beyond that, it's always struck me as something that's insane. Like, I wouldn't camp out for, like, what would you camp out for? I don't even know what I'd camp out for.
It's usually either concert tickets or to get into a big game. That's usually one of the two things.
Concert? So. People don't camp out for concert tickets
not
anymore.
Not anymore, but it used to. I mean, back in the day when that was literally how you bought the tickets at the window at wherever you were buying it back in the 70s and 80s, people literally camped out, you know, lines deep for it.
But I don't think there's I'm off the top of my head, I can't think of a single thing I would camp out for.
No, there's nothing I would camp out for.
Like, you got to be out of your mind. Like, that whole camping out thing sounds fun until you realize you got to sleep in a tent. Like, you ever slept in a tent? It's ridiculous.
I
will never camp, period. Like, not camp out for something, but just like straight up like camp in the wilderness. Like, I have no desire to do that.
Yeah, like this might be surprising because I grew up in Mississippi. I've never camped like that. I mean,
it's not surprising to me whatsoever. I don't even think you know how to change a tire, GP. But
I do know how to change a tire. I changed a tire outside of the Humphrey Coliseum one time in Starkville, Mississippi.
Yeah,
I was stranded there by myself.
I'm not opposed to camping. I run against both of you guys. I think camping in general is pretty cool, pretty fun. You know, get in touch with nature and all that BS. But overall, I'm with you when it comes to actually, you know, going for 72 hours, 72 plus hours, you know, waiting in line for something. That's
same way about clubs, right? Waiting in line for like to go into a club, like you
that,
see
that I will not do.
Okay, so like
almost always, yes.
Yeah, so like out in Vegas, that's the thing. Although we tend to have the hookup, we just walk right in. Like, I mean, perhaps because we're willing to let them charge like $5,000 on our credit card, maybe that's it. But either way, we get right in. But like I remember in a different life, like friends would be like, "Yeah, we're gonna go to this place tonight," and I'm like, "Okay." And we get there, and there's like this line outside. Like, we may or may not get in an hour. And I would just always try to think back throughout my life. I'd go, okay, have I ever had so much fun inside of a club to where it made sense to stand here for the next 90 minutes? And the answer is no, never. Or no more fun than I could have somewhere else where you don't have to wait for 90 minutes. Like, I can have fun basically anywhere. So, yeah, the camping out, standing in line, that ain't my thing, man. I don't. God bless those kids who do it. If they're having a good time, I hope they're having a good time. But
yeah, they were like talked to a few of them, and they were, it's part of, I guess, going to Kansas and these huge games, and it was pretty cool. The building over itself was obviously so awesome inside, and we can get to the game here, but I will say that it was so loud. It was at like my ears really started to hurt, and they did the decibel. If they did in the beginning of the game, I didn't see it. As we went to overtime, I think it hit like 118 for decibels. It was so freaking loud. The sound system in there, and the nature of the architecture of the building, was incredible and really cool. And then coincidentally, I didn't even realize this until game day, but not only did I get a good game, but they actually officially unveiled the rules that James Naismith wrote to the game of basketball back in the 1890s. And that was, there was a 30 for 30 dedicated to that, which is a really good 30 to 30 if you haven't seen it. And basically, it's this Kansas grad is convinced by the guy who makes the documentary that the rules should, you know, be in Lawrence, where, you know, James Naismith is buried and where obviously he coached at Kansas and all this. And it takes a while to convince this guy to do it. And then once he's into it, They do the bidding with Sotheby's over the phone, and it like keeps going up 2 million, 2.1, 2.2. And it's like, it's kind of like this amazingly gripping thing to watch. And so at halftime, which I don't think they would have showed this on TV, and if they did, correct me, but they have this whole thing about the rules and how they belong and Lawrence and all that stuff. But they take the like 2 minute clip from the 30 for 30 with, and I don't know the guy's name off the top of my head, but he was there in the building, but it's basically him countering, it's like him and two other bidders, and you never see the other bidders because they're over the phone. The whole thing is a bid over the phone, and it's like every time that someone else bids, he immediately is like, "Yes, I'll keep going." But like, it's an amazing piece.
What did he end up? What did he end up paying?
In Lawrence, what did he end up happening? Every time he bids higher, the crowd's like cheering. Really, really cool vibe, and for them to unveil it there was it made it even cooler. So.
I ain't trying to pay millions of dollars for some rules that referees don't even enforce.
I know.
They don't even enforce them. Like, really? Like, we make such a big deal about Dr. Naismith's rules, the refs won't even enforce them.
I know. It is a cool artifact given everything else that, you know, the ties to basketball that run so deep there. But anyway, that's maybe, you know, a not-so-abridged version of my trip there. But as for the game, I'll let you guys mostly talk about it. I will say it wasn't a... like, it was a very, very fun game, and it was interesting, and Seldon went off. And I did sit on Kansas practice on Friday, and Seldon was ridiculous. Like, he played really, really well in that practice, which I never take too much from. But he shot, like, 70%. It was, like, insane. And so then afterward, I was talking about Seldon and what he's done and everything since the World University Games, and he was not expecting that. I wasn't expecting Diallo to play as much as he did. And, you know, he was decent in stretches overall, but the game itself wasn't like super duper incredible. It had weird spurts and, you know, it had, Ulis played well until the end when he had a couple of bad turnovers. But overall, you know, getting into overtime and the foul disparity became a huge thing, which was, well-timed given my piece last week and what we talked about on the podcast. I had like so many people, hit me up and be like, yeah, listen to the podcast. Now I totally get what you're saying about the whistle at Fog Allen, just because Kansas made 8 more free throws than Kentucky even attempted. But a good win for Kansas, and yeah, certainly a very fun and interesting game. And I will say in the post game, Calipari was very good, all things considered. You know, I think the weight of the game and the team's meeting and all that stuff, I wasn't expecting him to be, you know, come in skipping and all that stuff or just be totally dejected. But he didn't look like a coach that was all too worried about his team going forward. And he was impressed with how they played, given the obviously very intimidating environment.
Yeah, you know what? He's typically good in situations where his teams lose games. That when his team loses a game, it's supposed to lose. Like, he typically handles that pretty well. What sets him off is when they lose games they're not supposed to lose, which is rare, obviously. But, like, it doesn't surprise me that he was, as the quote goes, a sick at his stomach after that overtime loss because they had it, or at least had a real opportunity to win in Allen Fieldhouse. It doesn't surprise me that he walks away, you know, feeling... I don't know if more inspired is the right phrase, but feeling okay about where his team might be headed. Sam, I'll ask you watched the game. Kansas is Kansas. They won inside Fog. They still got issues away from Fog. We'll see. Maybe they win another Big 12 title. Maybe they don't. We've talked enough about them. With Kentucky, do you walk away from this game, even in loss, even though it's a loss, thinking, you know what, they might really be turning a corner?
I mean, yes, I kind of thought they were turning the corner before the Kansas game, though. I mean, those 3 wins by, I think, like 15 to 40 points or 44 points or whatever over the course of a week and a half were pretty impressive over Arkansas, Vanderbilt, and Missouri. As far as the game against Kansas, I think that the bigger underlying issues here are just that their big men can't really do much because they can't stay on the floor due to fouls. I will say that, hey, like maybe there's a quick whistle at Fog Allen Fieldhouse or whatever, but the bigger problem here is that Scalabissier and Marcus Lee and Alex Poitras are all averaging something like 6 fouls per 40 minutes. Like, and that's before the game at Fog Allen. I looked it up. It was like 5.6, 5.8 and like over 6 per 40 minutes. And you know, whenever your guys are in that sort of foul trouble, it doesn't point to a quick whistle, Fog Allen Fieldhouse. It points to the fact that, you know, you're just losing the free throw disparity just night after night because these guys can't stay on the floor. And it's not like Jamal Murray or, you know, Tyler Ulis are guys who are going to be averaging a ton of free throws just because their games don't really kind of lend themselves to that. Murray is a guy that drives to avoid contact right now, and Ulis is a guy that kind of goes up and does the, he has that great floater game, but he's not necessarily a guy that's going to go all the way to the rim because of his height, because it's harder for him to finish. So I understand the idea that Kentucky fans might be a little bit mad about the free throw disparity, but I think that Kansas played aggressively right into those big guys that they know are foul prone. And until Kentucky kind of irons out those fouling issues that have been there all season, like this isn't just a Kansas thing, I think that they're probably going to struggle to keep their best players on the floor.
You know what? You make a point that I always try to make to people when they complain about free throws. And I'm not saying big picture, Kansas undeniably gets a favorable whistle inside Allen Fieldhouse, the way most great programs get a favorable whistle at their place, whether it's Duke at Cameron. Like, that's the, you know, the sort of the cliche in basketball is if you're going to win at Cameron, you better beat them by 10 points. Like, you're going to have to be 10 points better than them to beat them by a point because of the whistles. So I think in general, it is true that programs like Kansas and Duke, perhaps because of the stature of the program, perhaps because of the building, they get a favorable whistle. But typically, like, you hear this all the time. Like, it could be, Vanderbilt on the road at Texas A&M, like, where there's no, like, long-rooted, theory that, you can't go into A&M and, you know, expect a good whistle. Like, that's not a thing that people talk about. And sometimes the fouls will be, the foul numbers will look different. And I guess my point is this. I always say, okay, don't talk to me about the free throw numbers. Guess what? Because that's what the most fans always point to. They go, that we only attempted 22 free throws and they made 38 or whatever, right? And it's like, okay, I don't care about the free throw numbers, please, because what if they're playing zone they're playing zone and they're attacking into you, they're trying to drive and get to the rim, then you're going to foul more than they're going to foul. Like, the numbers, independent of anything else, don't mean anything to me. Tell me about the bad calls. All right, if you want to complain about efficiency, let's talk specifically about bad calls. Let's don't talk about free throw numbers, but sometimes that gets lost, you know. And sometimes, I'll be honest, the fan can go, well, it was this call and that call. And I go, okay, you got a good point there. Yeah, you got a bad whistle. But the free throw numbers in and of themselves rarely mean anything anything to me.
Yeah, like Texas A&M last week lost at Bud Walton Arena to Arkansas. They actually outshot them free throw-wise 35-24. And they got horrible, horrible whistles down the stretch, especially for offensive foul calls. It was a nightmare. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't look at free throw disparities and think that it's an automatic disqualifier of officiating necessarily. It's a silly way to look at things, in my opinion, it's a contextless way of looking at things.
Yeah, I think it's a silly way to look at things, like in your opinion, in my opinion, like in anybody's opinion who, like, understands that that's a silly way to look at things. Like, it's not even an opinion, really. It's just sort of it's just understand, if you're somebody who quotes free throw disparities as a proof of something, you're being silly. That's according to Sam. It's according to all of us. Right, Norlander?
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm just, you know.
Is what I would say. Okay, so now Kentucky, I think they were turning a corner anyway, right?
Yeah.
The double-digit win at Arkansas is impressive, particularly after you saw what happened to A&M when they went to Arkansas. Then they killed Vanderbilt, killed Missouri. And, yeah, like, you know what? They're starting to look like, and I pointed this out in Friday's Inside College Hoops column, like, they still got basically three first-round draft picks. Nobody else probably does. I mean, Sam, you follow this better than I do. At the high end of potential, now, I know Scal's not one of the best college basketball players right now.
But he's getting better, though.
He is getting better. He knocked down a couple shots the other night. He's getting better. He's not able to do it for 27 minutes, and a lot of that is foul trouble. But, like, he is getting better. He's at the very least, he's having these moments. And Bill has said this on the broadcast. Like, you know, when he knocked down one of those shots, like, well, that's it. That's why you see him on these mock drafts. Because, you know, take away all the other stuff. He's a 6'11 guy who can comfortably knock down that shot. Like, there's nothing – I don't want to say it's a natural jump shot because I don't know what that means. But, like, he's a comfortable shooter. That's the phrase I always like to use. He's very comfortable taking that shot and making that shot. And that's why he is projected to go in the lottery, even if he's been a mostly relevant college basketball player most of the season. But, like, I mean, is it still true if they're most talented guys start to play closer to their potential, forget the losses, forget the win, whatever, Kentucky's still the most talented team in the country? Is that a fact?
That's a really good question, because are we saying that, like, Kansas also gets their guys to play up to their potential gets, like, Sheck Diallo and Carlton Bragg and Spee there?
Yeah,
like,
I guess I would say, if you're trying to break those two situations down, Kentucky, I don't think this has – Kentucky has a better track record of actually maximizing their freshmen than Kansas does, if only because Bill doesn't always play his freshmen, right, the way that
– Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, so, like, there's a better – there's a more realistic chance that Kentucky's freshmen are maximized than Kansas's freshman. But, I mean, listen, Maryland's roster is really talented. Yeah. I think Carolina's roster is talented. But, like, my point is Kentucky's right there. And I made this point the other day. 2014, the year that the Harrisons were freshmen, they started the season 15-4 and ended up in the national championship game. And I won't be in this season, they started at 15-4. Now, their schedules weren't exactly the same, but the numbers were 15-4 to 15-4. And it will not surprise me at all if we look up and they're a 4 seed who makes the championship game, or a 3 seed who makes it, or even a 7 seed that makes the championship game. Like, if it starts clicking at the right time, they're good enough. They're good enough to get there. Watch the way I tie all this together. This is going to be amazing. If you remember back to 2014, the year I was talking about, the big round of 32 game, of course, was the 1-8 Kentucky versus Wichita State, and the Shockers yesterday won their 11th straight game. They handled Evansville easily, and I wasn't sure they were going to be able to do that. Like, at Evansville, and Evansville's pretty good. Now Wichita State's 15-2 with Fred VanVleet. They're 13-1 with Fred VanVleet and Connor Frankamp both in the lineup. So we talked early often about Wichita State when Fred was out and Anton Grady was out, and Landry Shamet was out and is still out before Frankamp was eligible. And we wondered, like, are they going – I think we all recognize that if they get VanVleet back and they run through the MVC, they'll be fine. But where we were probably wrong was that we all said, but are they going to be able to run through the MVC? That's just not something that looks like they're going to be able to do. Because at the time, Northern Iowa looked strong. Boy, like, is that the strangest one in the country, by the way? Northern Iowa?
They're up there.
You go from beating Carolina, and I know Marcus didn't play, but still, you beat Carolina and you beat – who's the other one they beat? Iowa State. And then, and then you just can't do anything. Like, right? It's them and George Washington. Like, how does GW win the games it won and then end up here? And you and I win the games it won and then end up here. Both with good coaches, too. So, like, anyway, back to Wichita State. We didn't think they'd be able to run through the Missouri Valley. They're running through the Missouri Valley, like, absolutely running through it. I mean, they look really good, right?
They do. So they have averaged 2.3 losses in the league the past 4 seasons. They're going to finish, I mean, almost definitely they're going to finish under that. And for the second time in the past few years, they're going to run the table, I would think, because the Evansville game was the toughest game remaining on their schedule by a long shot. I mean, Evansville is really the only legitimate team that's you can even consider a quote-unquote contender in the league, and Wichita State won it by double digits, and it wasn't remarkably close. They have turned themselves into a really, really good defensive team, and as we get more and more into this league schedule and they keep not losing and they keep romping teams, okay, romping them, every game is double digits almost exclusively, and many of these are clearing 20 points. So they're killing the league. And so as we move more and more into this, what we could have a situation that happen is, let's just say they don't lose again until the Selection Sunday, which would make for a very, very interesting story, because if they don't lose again until Selection Sunday, their seeding is going to be super interesting, because UNLV and Utah are the only good non-league wins. If they beat New Mexico State coming up in a couple weeks, I think that one's going to be okay. We'll see. RPI-wise, it's probably not going to help them, and obviously the RPI is still such a huge thing in what the committee does. But the point I'm getting at here is you'll have to really look at the games they lost without VanVleet, the three-game losing streak, and that will, I think, help them in a little way. But even still, I don't think they're going to have the wins that are going to launch them to a nice seed. So actually what I think is going to happen is I think if Wichita State runs the table, they're going to get slotted right into that 8-9 game. And
I don't think there's any way they're in the 8-9 if they run.
I think if they ran the table, I think that they could get a 9 seed.
Running the table involves being 25-5 entering the NBC, 28-5 overall, with three of the losses coming while basically VanVleet and his backup were both unavailable. And they would be at that point 25-1.
Oh, so you're saying even higher seeding?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they will, just because of the lack of wins. I think that they will deserve it, but I'm not convinced that they'll get a higher one.
If they ran the table, it'd be 25-1 with VanVleet and Frankamp.
Hey,
I'll tell you this.
If
I were a one seed and they got an eight after running the table, I'd be going crazy. That, you know, that's what happens sometimes. Like, we think the team that gets underseeded gets screwed. You know who actually gets screwed? The team that has to play the team that got underseeded. You know who got screwed last year? Virginia. You know why? Michigan State got underseeded.
Michigan State, yeah.
Like, that's the thing that, like, Tony Bennett's never made a Final Four. Well, like, last year, I don't know that they would have made it or not, but, like, they got screwed when Michigan State got underseeded. And, like, if you know who got screwed? And I don't even know that Kentucky got underseeded based on talent they did, like, 2 years ago. Wichita State got screwed. Like, they suddenly got to look up in the round of 32 game and play the preseason number one that's more talented than everybody in the country. Like, what in the world? Like, you can sort of see where, you know, fans of non-Power 5 schools think the committee's out to get them. And I don't think that was necessarily the case. But, like, I mean, you could see why, if you were a Wichita State fan, you might go, come on, man. We're an undefeated number one seed, and we got to play Kentucky in the preseason number one, the round of 32. What are you doing? And, like, my point is, they could end up being the underseeded team this year that screws a higher seeded team. If they were to run the table, like, right now they're 13-1 with VanVleet and Frankamp. Like, the committee is supposed to judge you, and I know that you don't disregard entire portions of the schedule, but they're supposed to judge you based on what you are of, you know, heading into the tournament, and they'll have three dudes, like three rotation players, available going into the NCAA tournament who weren't available in that three-game stretch around Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Anton Grady.
I looked it up.
And that's if they bring Landry back. And I don't know that they've made a decision on that. I actually think he'll probably redshirt, because a lot of it had to do, when I talked to Greg Marshall about this a few weeks back, he said, listen, ultimately it'll be Landry's call. And for people who don't know, he's like a top 100 freshman who was VanVleet's backup and was, like, good. I mean, not like All-American, but, like, a relevant play, like, ready to play as a freshman. Not all freshmen are ready to play. He was ready to play as a freshman. And, you know, I think they got to decide in the next couple of weeks what to do with him. And Greg said it'll be up to Landry. But, like, if there's two ways of looking at it. This is sort of an interesting thing. I'll ask you guys what you think. Okay, you got this kid who's going to be a rotation player. If not, like, he'll be your starting point guard for the next 3 years probably, right? And he could maybe come back in mid-February. But then you'd be wasting a whole year of eligibility. Do you just redshirt him and say, we're not going to waste a whole year of eligibility, particularly if Connor Frankamp's playing better. You know, we got VanVleet, Baker, Frankamp in the backcourt. We're fine. McDuffie's, like, great now. Or do you go, hey, this is the last VanVleet-Baker run we're ever making. We'll probably never have guards like this again. Let's just push all in and try to maximize whatever we can get out of this year. What do you do with Shannon?
I mean, I think that, like Marshall told you, it's ultimately his call.
Right.
But, I mean, I would probably push all in at that point. I mean, like you said, you're probably never going to have guards on this level again, even though, you know, Landry Shamet and I guess you can call Marcus McDuffie kind of a three, like a swing forward kind of guy.
He's become really good.
Yeah, like he's really, really good. I think that he's like he has a lot of potential to be an NBA player, actually. Yeah. Like he's really good. Yeah, I would probably push all in because you're probably never going to have that high of a talent level again.
That is the dilemma. Like, that is what they'll be trying to figure out. Like, do we just push all in, just whatever? Like, okay, we're going to use a year of eligibility, but we're going to try to maximize this last Baker Van Vliet thing. Or do you just save the year of eligibility? We'll let Landry and Greg make that call. A couple of other things before we get out of here. Buddy Hield got 32 points, made 7 second-half three-pointers down in Baton Rouge, come from behind win for the top-ranked Sooners. I think it's pretty clear at this point he's the National Player of the Year front runner. Like, I don't even know how you could make an intelligent argument for anybody else. Is it possible he's not only – he's, like, going to run away with this thing? It's starting to look like he might run away with this thing, right?
He might. Yeah. One, credit to Oklahoma for rallying the way that it did. I was sitting there watching that game with 40 and Luke Wynn on press row as we were kind of getting ready for our game to start.
Oh, name-dropping Norlander.
What's up?
Name-dropping Norlander.
Yeah. Nothing. Nothing like name-dropping sports writers. We all kind of felt that like LSU was going to give it, not necessarily lose, but they were definitely going to give up that lead. Sure enough, they did. And a lot of that's Oklahoma. I mean, listen, and watching that team in transition is just awesome. I don't know what it's going to take for Buddy Hield not to win the Player of the Year at this point. He would have to completely regress to the mean in a way that he has not shown at all this season. And Oklahoma is so roundly talented. He's almost got the perfect situation in that he's got a really solid, solid overall supporting cast. And so he's not carrying the team. He is simply elevating the team to, you know, an elite status within the context of this season. And so with that, and when you consider the games that Oklahoma has now gotten out of the way, he has definitely created some serious separation, and it would take a major downturn for him to lose the grip on that overall. It could happen, but as the days go on here, it looks more and more like he's gonna lock it up, and we're getting closer. We still gotta play a few more games here, but we're getting closer to a scenario where Oklahoma, barring, you know, an absolute collapse, is going to start really entertaining the idea of getting a number one seed. We got to get to at least Valentine's Day before we really start looking at those likelihoods. But incredible season continues, and yeah, I gotta think that it's his to lose, and it's going to be very hard for him to lose it at this point.
Last thing before we get out of here, let's look ahead to Monday night. The biggest game on the schedule, I suppose, is North Carolina at Louisville, and it comes after Louisville really, really laid an egg at the Yum Center on Saturday. They lost 63-47 to Virginia. So now they're sitting here. The computers love Louisville. Like, you know, they're highly ranked in everything, basically. But, they've got two top 50 wins, and it's Pitt and Florida State at home. Their best road win is over Georgia Tech. They don't really have any terrible losses except for the loss at Clemson, but as we've seen, basically anybody could lose at Clemson this year. And listen, it's a loss to Virginia, but a home loss to Virginia is not a good look, not lopsided like that. I don't know what to expect from them tonight. If you'd asked me a week ago, I'd have said, yeah, Louisville's going to catch Carolina at home. But like, I still think maybe they'll bounce back. You know, like Saturday could lead to a victory, Monday night. But they look terrible. And they don't have quality wins right now. I mean, every time I rank them, I do think they're one of the top 25 teams in America. But like, people love to point out how they really haven't beaten anybody. And I don't have much of a counter argument for that. They haven't. What do you make of Louisville as a basketball team, Sam, and Louisville's resume at this point? That again, the best win's either a home win over Pitt or a home win over Florida State or a road win at Georgia Tech.
Yeah, no, I think that you hit it right on the nose. They just don't have the wins, period. Pittsburgh and Florida State really aren't like surefire NCAA tournament teams by any means. And the offense on this team just kind of goes away from time to time, like in a way that you would not expect with Damian Lee and Trey Lewis and Donovan Mitchell. And even Onowaku's been a little bit more consistent offensively recently. I don't understand what happens with this offense. Honestly, I don't. I can typically kind of pinpoint one thing, but you know, sometimes the shooting just totally goes away with this team in a way that, like, it doesn't even seem like a matter of execution. It just seems like the shooting just disappears. Maybe that's just the result of having guys like Damian Lee and Trey Lewis, who are kind of getting into the dog days of playing up into ACC level play comparatively to CAA play and Horizon play. Maybe they're just kind of getting tired a little bit, but this is a really, really important game for them tonight against North Carolina, because coming up here, you got Boston College next Saturday. You have Duke, Notre Dame, Syracuse, Duke again coming up in their next four. And those are two road games followed by two home games. So they're going to have opportunities for quality wins at least, but this is a home game at the Yum Center against a North Carolina team that's rolling right now, and it could really make a statement. Whether or not that happens for Louisville, I don't know. But I wouldn't count them out. But it's just, yeah, this team is very, it's perplexing, I would say.
Norlander, North Carolina at Louisville. Who wins it? And by the way, do you guys say Louisville, or is that just a Southern thing?
It's Louisville. That's how you pronounce it.
It's Louisville. Good.
As someone who once lived in Louisville. It's Louisville.
You lived in Louisville?
Not Louisville.
You lived in Louisville?
Yeah, if you live there, it's Louisville.
You live there? When did you live there?
Back in the day, man.
What do you mean back in the day? Like you're being secret, like you were, like you're in the CIA or something. What do you
DITD, man. Yeah, absolutely. I did. I lived in Louisville.
Why did you live in Louisville?
No doubt about it. Back in the 80s, back when it was a real town, you know? Anyway, I don't even know what I'm saying. Carolina, I'll take Carolina to win. You know, I've been a seller on Louisville most of the season. I did acquiesce to the notion that this is a top 40 team, and I would still stand by that after not thinking it would even be a top 50 team coming into the season. But you know, the two notable wins in the league at Georgia Tech is okay, I guess, but really the home wins over Pitt and Florida State, and those two are kind of as erratic as they get overall. So this is absolutely a very, very big game. No doubt about it. We mentioned Wichita State. Let's see what Louisville does the rest of the year compared to Wichita State and see how many each of those, you know, programs have top 50 wise and where they get slotted and seated accordingly. Because you can't see how they're going to win at Duke. It will be tough to win at Notre Dame, you would think. And then they still have return games at Pitt, at Miami, at Virginia. I mean, it could really get ugly here. They got to win on their home floor. Carolina still, you know, Sam mentioned, you know, the Duke game upcoming, and then obviously the return Duke game on February 20th. So it could get dicey in a hurry, or they could just pick up a couple of needed wins and just assure themselves that they're going to get in and have some comfort getting into the NCAA tournament. The other game, by the way, on Monday night is Texas at Baylor. And we should probably hit on Texas real quick here, because now, I mean, it was a 9-6 team the morning of January 10th. And they were still, I think, in decent shape, because at that point, Washington was playing well in the Pac-12 or had a good start. They had the home win over UNC. It wasn't, I don't know if they would, you could consider them a tournament team on that date, but now they're unequivocally a tournament team. And Shaka Smart is seemingly getting his team on the track to a really nice seat as well, because they have, since they lost at TCU, which is TCU's only league win, I think, which is so bizarre and random. I'm checking. Yes, they're 1-7, and their only win is over Texas by one. But since then, beat Iowa State in overtime, beat Oklahoma State, went to West Virginia and decidedly won, have the road loss at Kansas, but that everyone loses at Kansas, got revenge on the Frogs, and then beat Vanderbilt over the weekend, and Vanderbilt's just a complete mess, so that's not necessarily a surprise. I think if they win tonight, then you'll really start to see people, you know, standing up and paying attention for the first time this season in like a widespread way. I mean, the Carolina win was nice and all, but now as we get into the thick of February, and I can't believe it's February already, my God, this would be a huge one to go on the road and win at Baylor, but I don't think they're going to do it. I think Baylor will win.
Yeah, they've got five top 50 RPI wins, and you know, only one loss outside of the top 55, that loss being, of course, at TCU. So they're clearly playing better, and playing better shorthanded. I'm not sure I expected that. But no, Shaka's got him headed in the right direction. Although, you know, Scott Drew never gets the credit he deserves, or at least it seems that way. But, you know, he's got Baylor, like, operating at the top of the league, you know, with a chance right now to what? Be the first Big 12 team tonight to go to 12 wins? I mean, to go to 8 wins? Is that 7 wins? Right? Because right now, Oklahoma, West Virginia, Baylor are all 6-2 in the league. So, do West Virginia and Oklahoma play tonight? They don't, do they? No.
I don't think so.
Yeah, no. So like Baylor could be the first Big 12 team to get to 7 league wins. And considering at their home, they'll be favored to do that, which means they probably should do this. All right, let's get out of here. You can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. That is the quickest way to get the latest episodes in your possession. So do that, please. And we'll talk to you again a little later on this week.